Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Thursday, June 25th. I'm joined by Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated and Tyler Wojciech of the Locked On Irish podcast. Welcome to the show, Tyler. Didn't know if you want to be initiated by maybe talking about guys that can throw 60 touchdown passes in a season or guys that are better tackles than guards when they transfer from high school to Notre Dame, because those are apparently our two topics that people like on our bingo card.
I've got some Cole Mullins takes ready to go as well. I feel like a minor leaguer being called up to the big league, so let's do it. I'm excited.
And Tim Priester, there are no CMU Pens fans questions, so no one is going to hit their bingo card on this particular one. But this will be, our segment one will be about recruiting, because it continues. Tim, let's just go back to we knew that Julius Jones Jr. commit was coming after our podcast. That was not a jinx. Maybe it counts as a jinx that his brother committed right after that. 2028 safety and 24/7 four-star Andre Jones, also from St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah, I mean, you know, well, first of all, Andre Jones, of course, he's in class of 2020, very physical football player. I mean, really a difference maker out there defensively. I don't know necessarily whether he'll end up being ranked as high as his brother Julius, but looks like a good football player with 2 years of high school still to go. But yeah, Julius Jones, you know, it's something that we talked about. We've talked about Kevin Stefferson, the receivers that can catch the football in stride, because it's just a natural instinct for people to slow yourself down a little bit before you make the catch to make sure that you make the catch. And I thought that was one thing that stood out about Julius Jones, in addition to being able to run the route tree, being very difficult to defend within that route tree. Great hands, confidence in his hands. You can see by the way he throws his hands up to catch the football that he's confident it's going to stick. So a really good pair. Now, Andre, his brother, is a little bit undersized at safety, but he's a hitter. And when you have a hitter, there's always room somewhere for a player of that magnitude.
With Julius, I think he's the best high school wide receiver to commit to Notre Dame in I don't even know how long. I was trying to go back and look at it. And I'm not saying he's going to have the best career, but right. Notre Dame has only signed three top 100 wide receivers in the past 10 plus years. It was Jordan Johnson, Cam Williams, and now Julius Jones. And I understand that's not necessarily great company at this point. I mean, Cam Williams hasn't panned out yet. There's still hope for him. But when you consider the high school that Julius plays for, St. Thomas Aquinas, one of the best programs in the country, the amount that he has produced for that high school already, and the genetics, which I think all play a part here, I think he is the best and has the best chance to succeed. I mean, there was Jane Greathouse, who's a big recruit, but he wasn't this level. Kadon Finley, same deal, went to a big high school, was a top recruit, but he wasn't top 75, and there's a real chance that Julius ends up in the top 50 by the time that this season is over. With Andre, he might not be as athletic as Julius, but I love his physicality. He is fearless. The fact that he's a sophomore going out there making those types of plays against some of the best high school teams in the country, I just love everything about what both those guys bring to the table. And it was a nice combo, because I expected Julius. I wasn't expecting Andre to take the mic like 2 minutes after and announce his commitment as well, but I'll take it.
You know, you make a great point, because I immediately thought to myself, well, Javon McKinley was pretty highly ranked coming out, and that was 10 years ago. So you make a really good point that if I have to go back 10 years, and also Javon McKinley took 4 years to become Javon McKinley at Notre Dame. So that's Chase Claypool, we all liked, but he was an undervalued recruit that you figured was going to hit. And of course, you already brought up Kevin Stefferson, way undervalued recruit that absolutely hit, if only for 1 year. That didn't matter in Notre Dame football history. Also, since our last podcast, we believe it's Sagun Alexander. Could be Sagun Alexander, but it doesn't matter, because he's coming to Notre Dame. And Tim Priester, this is the type of get that for 2 months, you, Pete Sampson, John Bryce have been saying, it's the interior guys. It's the interior guys that Notre Dame needs. They've found a way to get the edges. You can actually manufacture good edges too, but it's this type of recruit that makes it. You can take Notre Dame from sometime contender when you pile them up to perennial.
Yeah, and I don't know how Notre Dame fans were looking. I wasn't really giving him a whole lot of consideration up until recently. It was all about Braden Parks, and then, you know, Notre Dame gets a visit, and things change rapidly, and you start looking at the film, and it's like, I realize my film reviews are a little bit of hyperbole. That's kind of on purpose, the way they've always been written and fashioned. But I think what sets it, and there are a lot of times where you're watching a kid that's going into his senior year and you think, man, he's good enough. He could be at Notre Dame right now and playing. Well, this is a kid, you know, I mean, he's got all kind of eligibility left in high school. And I think the thing that separates him from some of the others is just his strength at this stage of his career. He runs through blocks. He bounces off of blocks. He's extremely physical, quick. You know, he has defensive end pass rush skills from the interior. You can move him around. I think he's a sensational player. And if they can get Braden Parks, and I realize that, you know, I'm getting a little greedy here, but it's Braden Parks. It's the godson of Chris Zorich. You got to feel good. You got to feel good about a half dozen sweep there. Maybe he ends up at Oregon. And Alexander's probably more three technique slash nose tackle, whereas Parks is more nose tackle three technique. So you can probably do without one of them if you had to. But this way, if you get Parks, you've got three defensive tackles in that class and three defensive ends. And man, that's a hell of a foundation to build around.
The attention that's been put on Braden Parks is kind of taken away from Segun Alexander. And I remember talking to your colleague, Eric Thomas, this time last week. And I was asking him, like, is Segun even going to make it to campus this weekend? There was some uncertainty there. Then he takes the visit and is a commit just a couple days later. And the reaction from the fan base is kind of interesting to me because Notre Dame defensive line recruiting has reached the point where landing a player like Segun Alexander, it doesn't send shockwaves through the fan base and message boards like the way that it used to, because they have recruited so many great players at the position, at defensive line as a whole in the past couple of cycles. But that should not diminish just how talented he is. I understand that right now the recruiting rankings haven't caught up to him yet. He's like not even in the top 500 players on the composite. I promise that is going to change. And this is the type of prospect that Notre Dame failed to land for so many cycles. And it's to the point where now it almost feels like they're hoarding at the position. That's definitely going to be the case if they get Braden Parks. He is so gifted. And this looks like it's going to be one of the best defensive line classes Notre Dame has signed in a really long time.
Yeah, I kept pushing back about a month and a half ago saying, well, remember Eshak and Williams and Tuitt and Springman were a great class, but and Eshak was a great recruit, just like some of these guys. But man, you're dwarfing that now if you keep this momentum up. No podcast jinx. We are recording now and officially.
There are no jinxes, Tim.
Well, David, I believe in David Ortiz, but not jinxes. You're right. That's a segue for another time. Trey Tagliaferri, committed to Notre Dame, Bergen Catholic quarterback. Tom Loy liked him more than Kingston Prier. I don't agree with that, but bird in the hand. And Bergen Catholic is now our conversation, and the Kingston Prier recruitment took a really weird turn of demands that were unreasonable. So here Notre Dame is stacking quarterbacks over the course of the summer as well.
Go ahead, Tyler.
I love his arm talent. I agree with you, Tim. I would not put him over Prier. He is not the biggest guy. He's not the most athletic guy, so I don't think he has the same ceiling as Prier does. But you could make a compelling argument that Trey Tagliaferri has the best arm in the class, and that's certainly exciting. I have some concerns about his ability to process, like the way he sees things when he's out there, but he's still very young. I do not expect him to reclassify. He should not do that. And I think some of that, you know, football IQ processing, that can be taught over a long period of time. You can't teach God-given arm talent, and he certainly has that. It is interesting, though, because it's my understanding that Tagliaferri was on the same 7-on-7 team as Teddy Girard at one point, and he left that team because he couldn't play over Teddy. Now they're going to be on the same college team. Now it's a little bit different since Teddy Girard reclassified, and he's not just one grade above. Now he's two. But you look at it, Tagliaferri might have a better arm than Teddy, but Girard's processing ability, his football IQ is way above that. So you can afford to take a risk on Trey's arm talent when you have guys like Teddy Girard and Noah Grubbs, then Champ Mott's coming in 2027.
Yeah, Tagliaferri should not reclassify that. He needs to get stronger. I know I'm always preaching about quarterbacks getting stronger and CJ Carr getting stronger, but he just needs to get stronger. What, you know, he does a great job. Like, he doesn't have a cannon. He's got a long arm. I think he can air it out. Now, if you look at his film, receivers have to wait on his throws a little bit, but he's a young guy and he has a couple years, and so he needs to take advantage of that. But he does a great job. He has a great feel for the pass rush, and when going from decision to get rid of the ball to actually getting rid of the football is extremely quick. He's really, really good at that, and that helps him avoid sacks and get rid of the football and make some plays. But 3 for 3. I think Prier has a higher ceiling. He's a bigger framed kid and a guy that, you know, is going to overall run the football better than Tagliaferri is. But you know, a sophomore in the film that he put out there, I think was very impressive. And look, sometimes, you know, your first choice doesn't come through. And so you have to adjust, and Notre Dame adjusted immediately. And now they have a quarterback in that class coming up.
Early Monday evening, Tom Loy posted on the IrishIllustrated.com message board that he spoke with a source at Notre Dame and top 100 offensive lineman Albert Siemian, who we've discussed at length, Priester, over the last couple of weeks, will make his decision Friday. Seems like it's Notre Dame or Texas A&M. Both camps feel it is not home state LSU. I know you've discussed, actually, let's start with Tyler also, because I know you've discussed Albert Siemian's film review and him on this podcast. Tyler, your impressions, and that's another guy that, well, we can make the joke, but boy, would he be a good guard at Notre Dame.
Yeah, I feel like whatever you're dealing with Texas A&M, it's fair to be a little cautious until he actually signs with Notre Dame, especially after what Notre Dame just went through with Caden Henderson. But at this point, all indications point to him committing to the Irish tomorrow on ESPN. We're going to have to wait and see if that ends up being the case. But if he does, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that in a year, maybe 2 years, Notre Dame could put out an offensive line that has five-star, like former five-star recruits with Will Black, Grayson McKeough. You have Olu Olubobola and potentially Albert Siemian as well. Siemian feels like the most natural fit on the interior. A lot of those other guys are all tackles. So they're going to have to figure that out once they get to college, because Notre Dame is hoarding on the offensive line just like they are on the defensive line now. But Siemian is a guy who kind of reminds me of Quentin Nelson coming out of high school, because Nelson was a five-star, but he was advertised as a guard, even though he wanted to play tackle early on. I don't think there's going to be much fight from Siemian. I think he's going to play on the interior, and that's probably going to give him a much better chance to play early at Notre Dame.
Yeah, Quentin Nelson being moved to guard was one of the best things that ever happened to him, although he's going to be great either way. But yeah, I agree. He's an interior guy, plays a little upright, but what an athlete. I mean, a guy that size that can move like that with the physicality, he's a great athlete. And I hadn't thought of it in terms of five stars starting along the offensive line, but that's Tyler, you're absolutely right. That's legitimate. And he's legitimate. There's so much to like about him. He's got to work on knee bend and pad level and right now he blocks shoulder pad high. Well, it's hard to get leverage on a defender when you block that way. So he's got to get underneath the pads a little bit, but he's big enough and strong enough to do that.
Before we discuss the recently passed age-based eligibility ruling by the NCAA, once again, the NCAA is making sense, guys. It's like 2 years in a row they're making sense in the offseason. I want to mention that 2023 recruit Brennan Vernon has medically retired. He was not on the Notre Dame roster, checked with Notre Dame, and it's a medical retirement for Vernon. I looked back, and I had Vernon 14th in the class of 2023, and my note was I thought he would play by his senior and fifth year at Notre Dame, that type of guy that would progress through the system. Instead, he helped the scout team last year on offense and defense, and I don't know if he ever would have made it or not, considering the recruiting they've had since, but did not help him that he had to gain weight and then lose weight and then gain weight. Gain weight, lose weight, and gain weight to play at Notre Dame.
I don't remember where I had him, Tim, but it was probably a little bit higher than that. I really liked his high school film, but he committed really early. And as you start looking at other guys, he really fell back for me. But, you know, I mean, I feel like, and chime in on this, Tim, Tyler, I feel like he fell behind the competition, like, right out of the gate. Yeah. And maybe it had to do with the weight gain and the weight loss and adjusting a new position. And that, you know, that can derail a football player or recruit. But it just seemed like quickly out of the gate, Notre Dame's defense wasn't counting on him in the short term or the long term. But he's got a Notre Dame degree, and I'm sure he'll do just fine for himself.
I looked this up this morning. Do you remember where he was ranked in the country at the time he committed? Like I knew that he was a big time recruit, it was a huge deal, but he was the ninth ranked player in the country, regardless of position, when he committed in June of 2021. I remember it being a big deal.
Precipitous drop after that, but yeah.
That shocked me. Yeah, he ended up being ranked outside the top 200 prospects in the country by the time the class rankings were finalized. And I think a big reason why so many people were high on him so early is because he was so big and he was playing on a pretty powerhouse program at Mentor. And that's basically like a feeder school for Ohio State, or at least it used to be. So the fact that he was able to get out there and play very, very early on in his career, I think a lot of people just sort of projected him to stay on that trajectory and keep getting better and better and better. And then that just didn't really happen. I got a chance to see him up close twice during his senior year. He played against my cousin who played for a different public high school, the same school that Drew Aller went to. And I was really excited to watch both those guys. And as the game went on, I was like, okay, like kind of waiting to see it from Vernon. And then it just didn't really happen. I'm like, okay, that's one game. And then they played each other again in the playoffs. And he still just didn't really have that big of an impact on the game. Certainly not to the extent of a player with his profile would suggest. So I was a little bit skeptical when he got to Notre Dame. And then unfortunately, those concerns came true.
It was a pretty good class still around in 2023. I count 11 real players. And then three more guys, and I'm talking three more guys on the outside looking in that are more on the inside at this point, like Armel Mookum and Joe Otting. I mean, they're in, really. The guys that remained is a heck of a class. The guys that transferred out were pretty good in Sam Pendleton. Rico Flores, I contend, would have been good at Notre Dame eventually. And remember, they lost in that class. My number one ranked recruit is Jeremiah Love, patting myself on the back. But number two was Peyton Bowen, who didn't make it. So Priester, you definitely wanted us to turn these in the day before that this happened. And my number 11 ahead of Kenny Minchie was Brandon Hillman, who also did not come to Notre Dame. So this was an interesting 2023 class because they've had some hits on this one. My lowest rated hit right now is Cooper Flanagan down at 16. And Sullivan Abisher 17. That's a pretty good class.
Don Shuler's
way
down there.
Way down there, yeah. Don Shuler was my 15. I hope they had Brandon Vernon right ahead of him, so I can unpat myself on the back after that one. But and it's funny, I listed Caleb Smith. That was KK Smith. Caleb Smith is on here. And Armel Mookum can prove us all wrong. I had Mookum down at 23. And Armel Mookum, if he can finish off a couple years at Notre Dame with quality interior reserve work, I think he would have proved most people wrong. I do know, since we mentioned Tom Loy on this podcast twice, Tom Loy did like Armel Mookum more than the rest of us. I recall that being a thing.
Well, 24/7 had him ranked 193, and the composite ranking was 515, I think. So some other people, you know, saw through that. But you want to talk about transition. I mean, Mookum was a defensive end, and he had to gain weight in order to become a defensive tackle. And I think they made that decision as soon as he got to Notre Dame. So you're immediately in transition mode, and that's difficult. But he was, by the way, he's today's number 42, counting down. Is it 42 or 41? Counting down the Irish, and he's got a shot at being the number 5 defensive tackle. He better make a move.
That's playing time over the course of the
year. Yeah, but he better make a move. Like if he wants to be back next year with the influx of young talent possibly coming at defensive tackle, a spot on the roster may be difficult to hold.
Guys, last year the NCAA grandfathered in some players when they reduced scholarships from 120 to 105. That was a rare, great decision by the NCAA. And this year, this one makes a lot of sense. We've been talking about it for a while, age-based eligibility. A lot of it, we've been calling it 5 for 5. Basically, you enroll in college after your 19th birthday, or from the moment you enroll in college, you have 5 years to play college football. Injuries, red shirts don't exist anymore. You have 5 years to get in and get out. That would have negatively impacted Jason Onye this year. It does not. It's not retroactive. It does not impact Jason Onye, but you have 5 years in and out, and that takes effect going into the 2027 season. Guys, it made too much sense not to do it because the 7, 8, and 9 year seniors. I do feel sorry for some oft injured guys for the sixth year, but the 7, 8, and 9 was getting a little crazy.
Go ahead, Tyler.
Yeah, when I was looking through Notre Dame's roster, I thought this would impact more players. And on paper, you know, there's Drake Bowen, Ashton Craig, Jordan Faison, Christian Gray, Elijah Hughes, and Luke Touch in terms of guys who had 1 year of eligibility left and now they're going to have two. But like out of that group, I really only think Elijah Hughes and Luke Touch are going to be back next year. And that's great because Touch could be a starter next year. I know that you guys talked about him potentially transitioning to linebacker. I think there's been some discussion about maybe that's his best chance to play in the NFL. How is that going to affect him at Notre Dame? We'll have to wait and see. But having Elijah Hughes around for another year would be a huge help. But as you look beyond that, guys who had 2 years of eligibility left that will now have 3, the biggest one is Spencer Porath. Because now, if he's around, Notre Dame isn't going to have to go out and get a one-year rental at kicker every single year. And so far, there have been some peaks and valleys, yeah, I guess we should say, in that process. So that was the one that really stood out to me, because, like, I don't expect KVA, Aeneas Williams, Anthony Knapp, Leonard Moore, any of those guys to be around 3 years. But if you get two more years of Elijah Hughes and Luke Talich, and you get three more years of Spencer Porath, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, Porath was one of the guys I pointed out in today's Thursday Thoughts, because I viewed it the same way, Tyler. You know, Jordan Faison, he led the team in receptions last year and has a really good chance of doing that again this year. You know, but how high of a draft pick is Jordan Faison? Now, let's project. Let's say he has 60 catches and 8 touchdowns, and, you know, he's good. He has great speed, and he's stronger, and, you know, maybe things change a little bit. But these are all, you know, you got to see what happens in 2026 to see just how valuable Jordan Faison is to the NFL game. But I think there's a possibility that staying at Notre Dame another year would be more beneficial to him financially anyway than going to the NFL.
My thought on Faison, he'll make more money at Notre Dame than a day three pick would. However, not he's a rock and he's a dog out there, but a healthy Jordan Faison going to the NFL stands a much better chance of playing in the NFL for a while than another year of Jordan Faison being Notre Dame's number one receiver, playing 15 games, taking a beating. Sometimes I think you just strike and go when you have a chance.
And he probably has that confidence in himself.
Yes. Drake Bowen, the same thing. Does Drake Bowen really want to start another year of grinding at Notre Dame?
Yeah.
You know, that's tough.
And I kind of look at Christian Gray the same way. As beaten up as he was last year, I can't imagine him, you know, although again, financially, maybe it would be better to stay at Notre Dame in 2027, but you know, that's not a real big body, and we saw what he put himself through last year.
Imagine there's also a chance. Oh, go ahead, Tim. I was going to say, Faison kind of comes off to me as a candidate, as a player who gets drafted higher than, like, the general consensus on him, because I could see Sean McVay, Kyle Shanahan, Kevin O'Connell, like that coaching tree. They all love players exactly like Jordan Faison, who get open, they're extremely quick, they have solid hands, and they're also very willing blockers. Like, that's everything that Jordan Faison is. And I did see Mike Renner of CBS Sports. He did a way too early mock draft. He has Jordan Faison going at number 31 overall. Now, Mike Renner is a Notre Dame grad. There might be a little bit of bias there. I don't think most scouts would have him as a potential first rounder, but I do think that there is a chance that he gets drafted a little bit higher than most other teams would probably take him, because he is such a perfect fit for a few specific offenses.
Two things. Drew Mentok put his – we were asked to make a – almost outlandish prediction on a summer podcast. And he said, Jordan Faison finds his way into the end of the first round of the NFL draft, kind of like Jadarian Price did. And number two, imagine being Spencer Porath, just a matriculating student that wants to go find higher education at Notre Dame. But all of a sudden you find out they have a football team and you can kick for them. And then you get an extra year to kick for them and they're going to pay you for it. I can't believe the luck, the good fortune that young man has, because, and then he can actually go visit some of his old friends. They're going to be actually playing his alma mater. So that's, or his, not his alma mater, his former spot.
Yeah, and I also want I think I'm going to refer to it constantly or consistently as 5 for 5, but the 5 for 5, you know, recruiting classes will be a little bit smaller because the retention of your roster from the previous year will be a little bit greater. So maybe a little bit less high school influx on a yearly basis, which is maybe not great for, you know, those that are aspiring to land at a Power Four school and have to, you know, go to the Group of Six. But you're going to have teams with a little bit more experience when those guys choose to stay for a fifth year.
If you've ever thought I should really start a sportscast about my team, Zen AI makes it easy to actually do it. Zen AI is the home of vibecasting. You just have a real conversation and it turns into something worth sharing, whether that's a sportscast, clips, or TikToks. No production skills required. Your phone is the studio, so you can record from the couch, the bar, or walking out of the stadium and still get solid audio without fancy gear. At the heart of Zen AI is an AI-assisted producer that cleans up your audio, finds the best moments, and creates share-ready clips you can tweak just by chatting in plain English. Vibecast live as the game unfolds, or jump on right after for instant reactions and analysis. Bring your own co-host or find another in Zen AI's network, hit record, and you've got a draft of your sportscast ready by the final buzzer. Humans are the talent. AI is the infrastructure. Vibes required, production optional. Zen AI is invite only right now, and they're actually paying new Vibecasters to create their first Vibecast. So try it as a one-off, short, raw experiment. Go to zen.ai to join the waitlist, or hit the link in our show notes for a shot at early access. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question from K Garrity 1. Have we seen a position coach at Notre Dame this effective slash completely flip the narrative in terms of recruiting in such a short span of time? And related, is Charlie Partridge the best hire of the Freeman era? Tyler, we'll throw this one to you, and this Charlie Partridge recruiting train is a rolling.
The only person I can think of is Marcus Freeman and what he was able to do with linebacker recruiting after he took over as defensive coordinator and also linebackers coach. Because in 2022, Freeman's first recruiting class after he became the defensive coordinator, Notre Dame signed Jalen Snead, who's a five-star, Josh Burnham, who was a top 100 player, and even though he ended up moving to defensive end, he was a linebacker coming out of high school, as well as junior Tui Alamaka, same deal, but he was still a high four-star linebacker. Notre Dame had to get him over USC. Each one of those was like a big win for Notre Dame on the recruiting trail. And in the class before, in 2021, Notre Dame signed Prince Kali, which was a big deal at the time, Will Schweitzer, and Devin I already forgot how to say it, even though we talked about it during the break. Either way, not super relevant players to the success of Notre Dame. Mike Mickens was able to do it eventually, but it took him a few cycles. So for Charlie Partridge to do it with this drastic of a turnaround, even though last year's defensive line class was a big improvement over what we had seen in the years prior to that, I certainly was not expecting this. I thought Charlie Partridge would be great as a developer of talent, and there's still a very good chance that he's going to do that. But from the recruiting perspective, what he has done in just over the span of a few months is unbelievable, and it's really surprising to me.
Now that I think about it, Tyler, and you'll probably never have to pronounce the name again, I think it was Aupue. But he never made it to Notre Dame. But the question from Kay Garrity about short span of time, and Tim, you mentioned, I mean, Mike Mickens. Well, it depends on your definition of short span of time. Maybe not right out of the gate when he got to Notre Dame, but suddenly after that, he was zeroing in on three stars and turning them into five stars in first and second round draft picks. So I would say Mike Mickens. I know Vinny Serrato did not actually coach a position at Notre Dame, but you want to talk about a guy that immediately, you know, and Jerry Faust recruited top rated players, but that was in the day of Parade magazine, and the analysis of top rated players was not nearly as thorough as it is today. But the change in his approach and the type of athlete that he could bring into Notre Dame was pretty rapid after the end of the Faust era.
And I'm not saying Mike Mickens wasn't great at this, but people weren't as excited about Mike Mickens' recruits. They just became great.
Yeah.
Like Mike Mickens, yeah. Leonard Moore, Benjamin Morrison, Jaden, people weren't running all over the place when he was getting those guys. It was, they just became great. And also, by the way, it's okay to become great and become Benjamin Morrison. And
that Leonard counts Moore. Too.
That's actually even better than recruiting great, because then you have bird in the hand. But yeah, that's tough. Good call on Marcus Freeman, who we're going to have another. I'm going to mention Marcus Freeman later in this podcast for his assistant coaching acumen. Next question.
I know what you're talking about.
Next question is Memphis Phil. Best guess, who starts at the following positions? Priester, why don't you go first on this one? Mm-hmm. Corner opposite Leonard Moore.
I mean, until we see DJ McKinney and say, wow, he's not as good as we thought he was, I'm not anticipating doing that. I think we've anticipated all along it would be DJ McKinney, because Christian Gray's working at the nickel in the spring, and I think that's the plan. They could adjust it, but I think that's the plan for right now.
I think it's DJ McKinney as well, for all the reasons Tim just mentioned. And he certainly looks the part. Notre Dame, the social media team has been pumping out some content with him. And I was like, okay, that looks like a grad transfer cornerback that has a chance to make it to the NFL.
The best thing about DJ McKinney being brought in to start here is he doesn't automatically get the job, because they have players. Like, if you really wanted Christian Gray not to be at nickel, we'll get to that. You have Christian Gray from the field. You have Jaden Sanders could probably pop out there and play. You have Mark Zachary. It's not an automatic thing. He has to win it. He's the odds-on favorite. Nickel, I think we're all in agreement, Christian Gray will win the job, but maybe share along the way, because it's a hard job.
Well, if he has to, you know, if for some reason McKinney isn't what we're thinking he is, then Gray would would stay at corner, and Golden, I think, you know, we're all very high on him, and he would slide into that top nickel spot. But right now, I mean, until we see something otherwise or hear something otherwise, it's McKinney at corner and Gray as the starting nickel.
Yeah, I think it's going to be Gray as well. I'd like to know a little bit more about the back injury that Dallas Golden suffered at the end of spring practice. I know that kept him out of the spring game. I'm just a little bit concerned because back injuries have a tendency to linger. And as someone who's had a history of back problems, they are not fun and they come back at the worst possible time. So, you know, I'm sure Dallas Golden is going to be out there in camp ready to go, but it would have been nice if he was able to finish spring practice at full speed.
Sounds like me talking about Madden Ferramo and Osborne's wrist injury. Not a good injury. It's not a good injury to have. The third receiver after Faison and Graham, and I know we're in agreement that Faison and Graham are the two main guys right now.
Tyler?
I'll say Micah Gilbert until I see Quincy Porter do anything on the football field.
That's fair.
Okay, well, I'll say Quincy Porter until I see Micah Gilbert do better than he did in the spring also in the fair. Two scrimmages.
And I'll go outside the box a little and say Jaden Greathouse will be playing football for Notre Dame at a higher level than he did last year. Maybe not the level we saw him against Ohio State and Penn State, but I'm going to go Greathouse. They're going to find a way to not pigeonhole the boundary receiver where he has to be that body. And Greathouse will finish third in receptions.
Okay, that's fair. I was thinking strictly Charter, boundary, right. And yeah. The order that I had was Porter, Gilbert. And, I think Devin Fitzgerald could do some things here in his freshman season.
I think we all agree if Quincy Porter and Micah Gilbert don't do what you two want to see them do on the football field, Devin Fitzgerald has been doing it. So let's see if he does it against the ones instead of the twos and threes. That's possible. And the final one, I actually wrote this in from Memphisville. Third running back in September versus November. Is it the same guy?
This one's a little bit more difficult. We don't know about Osborne's wrist surgery recovery. You know, we don't know about Kedron Young, his health, his size. He's battled, you know, some physical conditioning things along the way. I'll say Jonas Walton for now in September. And then, you know, then we're just guessing at that point. JV and Osborne in November.
I'll say Jonas Walton for both. I think the injury is really going to derail Osborne's freshman year. He could end up having a great career at Notre Dame, but I did not fully understand the extent of his injury until T.O. explained just how brutal of a process it is, not just dealing with the wrist, but the fact that you need another operation on your knee. It doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun, which is really unfortunate for him because I know that Sider was really optimistic about what he could contribute from day one. But then, you know, Jonas Walton took advantage of his opportunities in spring. He went out there, he made plays, and I think he's going to have the best chance to start the season at number three while Kedron Young comes back from injury. And I think Walton is good enough that he'll just keep the spot as the year progresses.
I'm going Walton for a kind of an odd reason. I think Walton brings what Williams and James lack more than Young does, because I don't think Williams and James lack any short yardage ability. I think they're good in short yardage situations.
I agree.
Compact, low pad level, getting what you need. Whereas Jonas Walton brings some speed that I don't think the others have. Yeah. I was really impressed by Jonas Walton when he hit a crease and hit the corner in the spring. He did not look like an 18-year-old playing football with Notre Dame.
No, I agree with you there, Tim. And if we don't say enough about Kedron Young, somebody will chime in that, hey,
talk
I think Kedron Young is
here.
Yeah, we've said it along the way. I would love to see him take advantage of his size and his power. He doesn't claim to be a power back, but when you're between 235 and 240, you need to be a power back. They need him to be that. That could be a specific role. I agree with you though, Tim. I don't think Aeneas Williams in particular is going to give anything away in terms of physicality playing the position. So, you know, number three's wide open. That's what makes it such a good question for Memphis, Phil.
Yeah, to your point, Tio, like the fact that Notre Dame has Williams and James Jr. and the one thing that both Sider and Mike Denbrock praise both those guys about is the fact that they're able to take a 2-yard run, turn it into 5-yard run, 5-yard run, turn it into 10. Where is that going to show up the most in short yarded situations when you bounce off tacklers? And that is like the one situation where it would make sense to bring in Kedron Young. But if the starters are already as good, if not better, then there's just really not a great opportunity for him to get on the field, even though I think Kedron Young is a really talented back. Notre Dame just has a bunch of those guys in that room. All right, me, number three. T.O., on Monday's podcast, you casually mentioned and breezed right past your greatest Brian Kelly story ever regarding Shaq Evans. Do tell.
I have told this story before, Maltese Irish, but I'm going to tell it again. It's a camp story. Brian Kelly's first camp. So he'd already been there in the spring, and he already had Shaq Evans going into his second year. Shaq Evans played a little bit for Weiss as a freshman. Ran the wrong route, actually, for Weiss, and they lost to Michigan. But Brian Kelly's – this is when we used to be like, we could be between the fields, remember, Priester? You didn't have to, which is not actually a great idea looking
now,
back.
Now we get cuffed and taken away.
Yes. Yeah, but between the fields probably was never a good idea for when they transitioned fields, but we used to be between the fields. And Brian Kelly in an early August camp, screaming at Shaq, colorful words, Shaq Evans did something wrong. And Evans' response was to walk away from Kelly while flipping him the bird. And when I saw that, I thought to myself, in first year coach Brian Kelly, this isn't going to go over well for Shaq Evans. Like, I think Michael Floyd would have gotten in trouble for that. And Shaq Evans, next time we were at practice, was transferring. And someone asked him, you know, did you try to talk Evans into staying? Because they weren't that deep at wide receiver. I mean, he would have started if he was dedicated. TJ Jones and Duval Kamara. TJ Jones, a freshman, Duval Kamara, and of course Floyd. And Brian Kelly's response was, I'm not that good at talking people into staying anywhere. And I was like, I don't think you want to talk that guy into staying anywhere, but I will never forget it. And Jeff Baumhauer, who was our recruiting analyst at the time with me at Irish Eyes and Scout, he looked at me, I looked at him, we're like, yo, Shaq Evans' era has ended. And so with that flip, I can't imagine someone doing that nowadays. Like,
well, they wouldn't do it to Marcus Freeman. No. I mean, that's
and obviously just... he had a foot out the door, right? Shaq, he must have had a foot out the door to do that. Yeah.
But he ended up being a pretty good player too.
He did. No,
he had two really good seasons in 2012 and 2013. I remember watching a game on TV and I heard Shaq Evans and I was like, that Shaq Evans? Turns out, good player.
Yeah, UCLA popped out just like with Devin Apuai or whatever Tim Priester
called.
Apu.
There you go, Apu.
All right, we move on to question number four from Malloy on base. Analysts often point to one or two above average or elite advantages that can decide a college football game. How many of those advantages does the 2026 Irish team possess, and what are they?
I think they have a bunch of advantages that we can point to, but they should dominate at least two of the three most common cliches when you're talking about football at any level, high school, college, NFL, hell, all the way down to grade school. Win the turnover battle, run the ball, and stop the run. I don't think they're going to have an elite run game, certainly not right out of the gate because they have to replace Levin Price, obviously, but they should be top three in the country in turnover margin because of all the playmakers on defense and how much they prioritize creating turnovers. And then, you know, quiet as it's kept, Notre Dame had an elite run defense last year. They finished seventh in the country in yards per carry allowed, and they were tied with Miami and Ohio State. That's pretty good company. I think they'll be even better this year. That was something that Chris Ash prioritized very early on. So I think they're going to be better in both those areas in 2026. And even if the run game takes a step back, if you win the turnover battle and you completely stop the opponent from running the ball, you're going to win a lot more football games than you lose.
For me, it's... Well, I asked a question. Tim, you got to respond. I'm sorry.
Turnover creation was one of mine. Just man-to-man coverage, including safeties. Like, they can cover anybody. Notre Dame can cover anybody. You can get, other than Leonard Moore, you can get anybody hurt and you can cover anybody. It's an amazing amount of depth you have out there. Leonard Moore is different because he can just completely shut someone down, whereas Jaden Sanders and Mark Zachary are good corners, good young corners. There's a huge difference, but they can cover anyone. I also wrote down the greatest differentiator in modern college football is they have C.J. Carr as their quarterback. And if you don't have to love the wide receivers, like Irish Illustrated likes the wide receiver, somewhere between like and love, if you poll all of us, if everybody's ever been on this podcast, Tyler, Bryce, Pete, all of Irish Illustrated, we either like or love. I'm in the like. They have CJ Carr. He elevates the receivers. So I think the passing attack and the ability to defend the pass will be top level by the time they need it to be.
All right. I wrote down four factors and you guys mentioned three of them. Tyler, I mean, for me, it's offensive line, defensive line, not only talented, but depth on both sides. And as I go through Notre Dame's opponents, their opponents don't have that kind of talent and depth. The second thing is CJ Carr and the accuracy, his motivation, his leadership, all those things. The other one that I would mention is the culture that Marcus Freeman has created. It's second to none. I don't know how you quantify that exactly. Can't put a number on it exactly. But the culture that Marcus Freeman has created in Notre Dame and the perception that he has created of Notre Dame outside of Notre Dame is really, really phenomenal.
I like the culture one. Also, there's that plucky young business student that kicks the ball for Notre Dame. I think it's really good that he is going to help out the Irish this year, because there's going to be times people are trying to figure out the trap game. There's going to be some weird time where, even if the game is not a one score game, that Spencer Porath's field goals, two of them, when you had a drive and nothing was happening, it helps extend it. So you're ahead 20-3 instead of the horrible 14-3 when you're going into the fourth quarter in those situations. Porath is going to matter. It's like Mitch Levins would be good to have on the team too. It's like Mitch Jeter would have been if healthy the whole time, because we saw what he really could do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's not automatic, but
very good.
If you saw what we saw during the spring of him kicking, it was a clinic.
And in comparison to last year, that was one of the most unenjoyable things I've ever experienced as a Notre Dame fan, watching the kicking unit out on the field.
Burnett was 5 of 6, I think it was. I mean, he was hurt so much that he only attempted 6 of them and made 5 of them. It was beyond that.
He also had 2 missed extra points.
Okay. They're overs. And the year before, they were 2 of 9 when Jeter wasn't kicking the regular season. It doesn't make any sense. It's just incredible. It's the old going. That's going to get Kevin Pender ass off the soccer field is what they wanted. They couldn't do it though. See,
it's true.
Next question: Irish 1981. Which coordinator? I like this question in the historical context of it because it's kind of funny. Which coordinator had a worse game number 2 of their tenure? Mike Denbrock, Northern Illinois, or Chris Ash, Texas A&M? But part B and more fun: what are other bad coordinator debuts or games by actually really good coordinators? That's the key, is they got to be good coordinators, I think. Otherwise, there's a lot of them.
T.O., we're on the same guy here. Marcus Freeman in 2021.
Yes.
For Notre Dame at Florida State, gave up a 442 yards total offense, 264 yards rushing. They won the football game. And so, you know, you could look past that. Plus, you knew he was a good defensive coordinator. Yeah. But he didn't have control of that defense out of the chute.
And then 29 against Toledo the next week.
That's true.
67 points in the first 2 games. He got better. Marcus Freeman improved in his coaching after all that, but that's a good one. Tyler, you have anyone to match that?
Mine was Marcus Freeman against Florida State. And I remember seeing Brian Kelly just giving it to Marcus Freeman on the sideline after Florida State. I think they broke off that long run. And after all the hype and praise that Marcus Freeman was getting in the offseason, you're thinking, man, he didn't even survive one half. Like, it's already over for him.
Coach
Freeman, it would have been over after Toledo if they had lost.
Coach Freeman referenced that moment with the media. I don't know if it was our private viewing interview with him in this last May or what, moment. But yeah, he brought that up. That was a good ass chewing from Kelly.
Yeah. I thought of a couple historical ones. This is so Bob Diaco game number 2 and 3. He gave was Denard Robinson with over 500 yards against Notre Dame in game number 2. And then he went to Michigan State and they lost 34-31. And later in the year, they had no answers for Navy, was the exact quote he used. And then we never talked to him again. So that was a bad debut season, around a great job by Bob Diaco. Gary Darnell's 4th game, Tim Priester, was Stanford 36, Notre Dame 31. And this is not the famous Bill Walsh Stanford. This is the team that
has Green.
Dennis Green, and they were losing record, and their other win going to this game was a 1AA matchup. And finally, Jim Coletto, who Priester's going to like this one because Lou called it the Blarney offense. His games, 1997, 2, 3, 4, and 5, were just as bad as anybody else's were. And I just want to bring up, so that was the beginning of the end for the 1997 defense.
We have got to look up Bob Diaco in Chapel Hill.
That's right.
He's the MVP of the program.
Yes. That's explain that, Tyler. That's good.
I have so many questions, but I believe someone who covers North Carolina came out and said that Bob Diaco was the MVP of the 2025 North Carolina Tar Heels. I have no idea what that means, how you become the MVP of a team that won, I think, 4 games and was one of the biggest disasters in all of college football. But hey, most valuable player, I guess.
Well, actually, yeah, I actually wrote about that in last week's Thursday Thoughts. And North Carolina, as we go through and analyze offense, defense, Notre Dame's opponents were much better defensively last year than they were offensively. And North Carolina, you know, they didn't give up a lot of big plays. I'm trying to remember exactly what categories it was, but of the 14 that we used, I think they were in the top 50 in 5 of those. So there is some validity to that. When you're in, as awful as North Carolina was last year, especially offensively, it you don't have to do a whole lot to be named the MVP coach of a team like that.
All right. We got number six. Oh, wait. Do we finish answering which coordinator had the worst game?
Yeah, I think we're.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Question number six, Bobby 1556 was wondering if Priester or TO could comment on this. Notre Dame's recruiting operations and results seem to be at an all-time high. In the heyday of Lou Holtz, was the recruiting this good? Was it better? The spotlight on high school recruiting and rankings wasn't as bright then as it is now. When Notre Dame brought in great classes back then, did you even know they were great classes?
Priester, can you? I think it was as good or better in 87 to 90 because they were ridiculous.
Yeah, well, I mentioned Vinny Serrato before. I mean, he was really, really good at his job.
49ers stole him, robbing Peter to pay Paul for young Tim O'Malley.
Yeah, you know, and of course Lou Holtz. If you had what it took to play for Lou Holtz, and you were drawn to his motivation, you know, look, we're so many years beyond that. The organization, the thoroughness of the process wasn't as far along, but you were selling Notre Dame. Notre Dame was an easier sell at that point, especially once, you know, Lou Holtz showed some life following the Faust era. So, you know, they were getting great players. Notre Dame's getting great players now. I don't think the process was
right,
you know, necessarily the same, but
5 days it was found out. But Priest, would it be fair to say like the average reporter, so not you and Lou Somogyi that were totally involved, but the average reporter would find out about Notre Dame's great class right before signing day. You'd look it over at signing day and you'd say, wow, that's one of the best couple classes in the country. Yeah. It wasn't like you guys were watching in February for signing day the next February.
No, we did have running water and indoor plumbing at the time, but the whole process was, was very, very different. I don't think I've said this on a podcast in a long time. There was a time when Notre Dame's scholarship offers were put out there by Notre Dame at the football banquet in December.
Wow. I have not heard that.
At the football bank, the weekend of the football banquet in December was when scholarship offers would go out. Now that probably changed.
They should try that this next season.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Like we've got stories on class of 28, you know, but that's, and Notre Dame, you know, I mean, how did they recruit? Not everybody was doing that. Everybody else was offering scholarships early. It was like, okay, if you're coming to the banquet and you're invited to that, it was an honor to be going to that and get your scholarship offer from Notre Dame. You couldn't, I mean, needless to say, you couldn't even possibly come close to surviving now.
All I remember as a kid, and this was high school kid, basically, early high school, I remember Derrick Brown being Notre Dame and Miami, and it was a huge deal that the Notre Dame 88 team got Derrick Brown from Miami. And that's all Brent Musburger talked about at the beginning of the podcast, at the beginning of the broadcast. I remember hearing about Rocket, but not the same as when you first saw him. And the next Rick Meyer doesn't count because he was down the road. So I heard about Rick Meyer all the time. But fast forward a little bit, and we knew all about Ron Paulus before he got to Notre Dame. But that's 5 years down, 4 years down the line. But Paulus was the first time I remember thinking, because it was Paulus, then Randy Moss, not to bring the whole boom down of everything in the podcast, everybody listening. But we knew all about those guys. So I think maybe by 93, 94. Oh, Scott Bentley from Florida State.
Scott Bentley.
Huge deal that the kicker went to Florida State instead of Notre Dame. So maybe by 91, 92, 93, it started getting there. I do vaguely remember knowing that 90 was an incredible class, and not the depth of it, obviously. And people wondering, it might have been you and Lou, wondering, why is 91 not as good? Like Huntley Bakich and Mike Miller were the main guys. And 90, you could just name College Football Hall of Famers. So we didn't know at the time, but that was the beginning. It went from absolutely.
Well, it was. And Holtz, God bless him. I mean, he admitted that he kind of dropped the ball in the later years. He talked about, I shouldn't have been maintaining. I should have been trying to enhance. Maybe he didn't say enhance. That's Marcus Freeman's word, but that was the spirit of what he was saying, that I needed to keep my foot on the pedal recruiting wise. And he didn't necessarily do that. And look, no matter, and the unprecedented, I mean, I guess you'd have to go back to Leahy before you had that string of success. But, you know, 64 wins in a 6-year period And he got a little complacent. And even in a place like Notre Dame with that kind of success, you still got to recruit your ass off.
And if anybody listening has not heard of Huntley Backich, please Google YouTube Huntley Backich and Lou Holtz face mask, and you will have be entertained the next minute of your day.
Question number 7, the Rick ND, with the 5-for-5 rule now in place, what true freshman is likely to make the biggest impact this year who wouldn't have likely played much otherwise because of a desire to redshirt? Could it be someone who we might see in a goal line or special packages?
Go ahead, Tyler. I have a couple thoughts on this one.
I struggled with this one because I feel like all the guys who I expect to make an impact probably weren't going to redshirt anyway. Like Marcus Freeman is not afraid to put a freshman out there on special teams if that's how they're going to contribute, because he prioritizes special teams so much, especially compared to some of the other top programs around the country. But to the point about someone who might see time in goal line packages, maybe Tiki Hola, because he's such a big body. But Notre Dame also has like Sean Civilano, who has been waiting to have his opportunity. So if it's not him, I thought maybe Teddy Girard, like he might see more action in blowouts if he ends up winning the backup quarterback job. They could try to get him in every blowout and not just four of them, assuming Notre Dame has the opportunity this year. But I honestly couldn't think of that many options because I feel like most of the guys who we expect to play as a freshman were always going to play throughout the year.
Yeah, it's a tough question. Like I still feel like Elijah Golden would not be as ready as some of the guys ahead of him. So you'd have to have a little injury involved in there. And I believe like Iwatade was going to play anyway. Maybe Iwatade ended up playing 4 games in the old rule, but now Iwatade would be a guy you could just say, all right, well, we're like Traore. At the beginning for Traore, it was, we better preserve him, you know, get him out. He got out there against USC. I think Iwatade might just, if they think, hey, he can give us 5 snaps, just go out there and play all the time. I love him as a prospect. Now I used to like him, and now I couldn't believe what I saw him. I was like,
we were shocked that he was 240 or 242, whatever he was.
He was play anyway. We can't be saying Rodney Dunham. Fitzgerald. That's not.
Yeah, that's it. Dunham was going to play. Premier's going to play. I agree with what you're saying too, Tyler, on that. Iwatade was the guy that I circled actually, but I agree, Tim. I mean, I think that there's a very good chance that, I mean, at worst, probably the 5th DN, maybe not at worst, because you got Logan Thomas in there and Keon Keeley. But yeah, that would be, I mean, that's a guy that normally under normal circumstances you say, okay, well, you know, he's going to redshirt. Now you don't have to worry about that. But Dunham and Premier were going to play. Now, another guy, you know, Joey O'Brien, great athlete, instinctual, but not really big and strong yet. So that would have been a prime candidate to redshirt, but now you can get them into games and get them accustomed to, you know, live action and some of these 8 lost teams that Notre Dame's going to be playing the first half of the season.
Iwatade's a good point, but how many guys of his caliber actually stick around for 5 years? Although you could probably have said the same thing about Jalen Seed when he was a freshman, like, why is he redshirting? There's no way he's going to be around for 5 years. And sure enough, here he is in 2026.
What did Pete say when I said, I'm amazed that Jalen Seed is still here? And it was either Pete or Drew in the last pass. He's like, not as amazed as Jalen Seed is still here. It's true, but he could have a good swan song. He could be the new Javon McKinley, only played a little bit more. Our next question is from Irish Gambler, and I think, Priest, you're only about 1/3 of the way into this answer, but you're going to answer it anyway. 1/3 of the way into your first-rate series, which team on the Irish schedule is most likely to turn a losing record from 25 into a 500 or so record in 26? He's thinking team improvement, not just because they play a terrible schedule.
Yeah. The first one that comes to mind, again, and I'm not through the defense, but it's Wisconsin, because Colton Joseph, I think, is a difference maker at quarterback. And again, they have 5 starters returning, which isn't a ton, but of the 13 or 14 categories that we used to evaluate before I started the first rate series, Wisconsin was in the top 50 last year defensively. So I think they can build upon that. I look at some of the things that Stanford has with the new head coach, Tavita Pritchard, new offensive coordinator who was co-coordinator at Virginia that put up some points last year, and then a new defensive coordinator from the NFL. Maybe Stanford, I don't think Stanford's going to finish above 500. I think Wisconsin could. So that's really the only one that I think would finish above 500. But I think Stanford could make strides. And maybe Michigan State, although schedule comes into play because they don't play IU, Ohio State, or USC. And maybe Pat Fitzgerald lights a bit of a fire there, but I don't see them beyond 6-6. Wisconsin would be my top choice.
Wisconsin's my choice as well, because it has to be Wisconsin or else Luke Fickell is going to lose his job. It's pretty simple at this point. They have to be better. They do have a win total of 6.5 right now on FanDuel. I just looked it up. So they have the best odds to turn it around. I think that, you know, with their new quarterback, the way that they've kind of stabilized things, they're in a better position. I know that the question says, don't talk about the schedule, but at the same time, Wisconsin's schedule the past 2 years was brutal. They had, I think, the hardest schedule in the Big Ten in back-to-back years, which was not ideal for the start of Luke Fickell's tenure with the Badgers. This year, it is much easier than it has been, so that kind of works out in their favor, too. They have a couple, like, automatic wins in there. And then I'm with you, TP, on Michigan State. Their win total right now is 4.5, so it wouldn't be that crazy for them to get to 6. Stanford would be a pretty sizable jump, though. Their win total right now is 3.5. So if they get to 6 or 7,
no,
that would be
not, no, they're far not going to, but I think they're one of the teams that can improve, but not above 500.
Yeah, I went with Wisconsin, too, just because there's not much else. I don't believe in Syracuse improving greatly. They're better. They would have been better last year. Let's put it that way. Without all those injuries, I don't know if it translates to this year, though. I think they could still be in some trouble. Michigan State, the first year coaching bumps, usually that lasts like four games, and one of those games is Notre Dame pounding them, so it takes away a little bit from there. But yeah, Wisconsin, I think across the board, they just have the worst starting. They just have the worst opening game of anybody in the country. Final question from T. McNear. For a few years there, it felt like Notre Dame was treating the quarterback position as a short-term rental market with guys coming in for a single season. And he's right. That's what they were doing. Can you talk about the psychological difference for the team when they're rallying behind a homegrown guy who's paid his dues versus a veteran portal transfer who dropped in for a 6-month business trip? Does the locker room buy in any differently?
I think it's a great question, but I don't know that it's necessarily applicable to Notre Dame's situation. I mean, do they buy into CJ Carr? Yeah, because he's motivated, he's committed, he's a leader, he's all of those things. But so is Riley Leonard in a much different way. And he was named a captain. Now, I know Sam Hartman was too, but, you know, Riley Leonard was beloved because he was so genuine. Certainly the media, our interaction with him was, wow, is he genuine? You know, I'm sure the players felt that right from the very beginning. You can't be that deceptive and pull that off with your teammates. So I think it just depends. I think it's more the individual that is your starting quarterback. There aren't a lot of Riley Leonard personalities out there. And frankly, there aren't a lot of CJ Carr personalities that are as motivated and driven and locked in and committed to the process like CJ Carr is.
Right. I don't really know if it matters too much psychologically, because I feel like student athletes now, they understand the transfer portal and what it is like. They are so much more accustomed to it, seeing guys leave and then enter their new school. It's much different than how fans interpret it. They just kind of understand it's a business. It is what it is. Guys move around all the time. And even if it happens less at a place like Notre Dame, all these guys played high school football. They have teammates who are transferring all around. So from that standpoint, I don't think it's as big of a deal as some people make it out to be, but it really matters in terms of reps. Like, I'm sure it helps that Carr has been throwing to a lot of the same guys for 3 years now. They've been operating from the same playbook for multiple years. He knows the wide receivers who've been around, their strengths and weaknesses. Whereas like Sam Hartman had to get on the same page with a bunch of freshmen who were just trying to learn how to play college football. Riley Leonard was able to acclimate himself within the locker room, but he missed all of spring practice. He didn't really get any reps until the summer came around. So he was working from way behind. So it probably does help in the locker room a little bit from a psychological standpoint, just having someone you know who's been around. But I think it matters way more actually on the field because of the years of practice reps that you've accumulated.
I think it's such a transient college football world, like you're mentioning. It's pretty easy to rally around CJ Carr because he's so good. But if it was Drew Pine here returning for his second year as a starter, I think every Notre Dame fan would embrace bringing in Darian Mensah as their quarterback of choice. Like, and Riley Leonard's just, that's, he's a unique example too. I mean, that's the guy hit campus and everybody had to like him. It was a unique person. He's a great guy. And Jack Cohn was a really respected veteran to come in.
Yeah.
And he walked into a situation. They needed him. They absolutely needed him.
More of a, I don't even know, I would say quiet leader. He was very quiet, but he just went about his business and did his job and was, you know, once they got past all the sacks that occurred in September, he settled in pretty nicely. He's one of the most misunderstood quarterbacks at Notre Dame because a lot of people don't realize what he did the second half of the season.
The Toledo game too, by the way. Yeah, that would be a bad loss. Right.
Yeah, and we desperately were saying he should get another year. I still don't understand that decision by the NCAA.
What they had to do was find a St. Joseph's County judge. Yeah. It was really that simple. He just didn't know
That's what I'm wondering. I wrote it in today's Thursday Thoughts about the 5 for 5. Okay, this is the rule until it goes to the courtroom because somebody's going to sue.
Yeah. Great question, though, by Trent, because McNair, I can see if Kenny Minchie was the guy to rally around. Let's say CJ Carr somehow went pro, you know, and some just went pro after the last year. You're not allowed to, but let's say he did. If Kenny Minchie paid his dues all those years and stayed and they were bringing in a transfer, I could see the team being like, you know, we really want Kenny Minchie to be. But that's because Kenny Minchie's good.
Yeah. Too. That's a unique circumstance, too. Like, did Fernando Mendoza have any trouble winning over the locker room at IU? No. Did Will Howard? Not really. Those guys won national championships. Like, it just kind of is what it is in college football now.
I think Fernando Mendoza and Riley Leonard – personality-wise, have a lot in common.
Likeable guys, and this was a likeable podcast, especially with special guest star Tyler on board here. That Tyler, thank you very much for joining us. That was fun. We will be back on Monday, June 29th, pre-July 4th holiday. Yeah, we'll be back on a Monday for a podcast. And I hope there's a little more recruiting news coming Friday. If not, we'll make something up, right, Tim Priester? That was a fun thing to do. No, but it's been a bonanza here of recruiting at Irish Illustrated Insider. Every time you sit down to write segment one in the offseason, you think, did they get anybody? This time it's like, yeah, I just got to keep penciling in all these 4- and 5-star recruits to talk about. And that is not the norm in June. For Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated and Tyler Wojciech of Locked on Irish Podcast, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening. Irish Illustrated Insider.